The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This hour, we're taking a look into the future of the human species. How will technology help us live longer, healthier lives? And how will we get access to new medications that might make that possible? Later on, we'll talk to science writer Jessica Wapner for a look at the ethics and economics of drug development. And right now, author Mark Stevenson joins us to discuss his new book. I'm here with writer and comedian Mark Stevenson. Mark is a director of the cultural learning agency Flow Associates and the science communication agency ReAgency. He's also part of a new mobile project, The Age of Smart, which intends to stimulate learning and direct action within an audience of 300 million users. Mark is the author of An Optimist's Tour of the Future. One curious man sets out to answer, what's next? Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Mark.
Wonderful to be here.
So, were you an optimist before the book or as a result of your research?
When I first pitched the book, it didn't have the word optimist in the title. When I was talking to my agent about it, I said I wanted to write a book called A World Tour of the Future, which is really just my attempt to try and make sense of a rapidly innovating world. And I don't know about you, but the sort of information I get from the press and its reflection in our politics about things like the biotech revolution or what's happening in nanotech or what's happening with the climate or how the internet is affecting us was pretty ropey, and I couldn't really get hold of it. And I wanted to write a book that was for the layperson, really, about all these technologies, because I did find a lot of popular science books were written for people who read Scientific American or who read New Scientist, and I have nothing against that, but I kind of wanted to write a book for my mum. So I went off on this journey, essentially, to just find out what was going on and followed my nose and asked lots of questions about nanotechnology and biotechnology and so on and so forth. But by the time I'd come back, I was so inspired by some of the options that we have that I hadn't really heard about, that the word optimists kind of crept into the title.
Well, it's not only that you went out and asked questions, you asked these questions of amazing people about a truly broad swath of future-related topics.
There's a great quote about getting an education from MIT, which is like taking a drink from a fire hose. And I had pretty much that feeling for a year. And I have to try and make sense of it. And the last bit of the book is called Reboot, which is where I'm talking to philosophers or business leaders to try and make sense of how this all fits together. So, yeah, I was very lucky. But the thing is, you can't wander into, you know, one of the leading practitioners in nanotechnology or genomics or robotics and just go, so, hey, what's up? You really have to do research.
Exactly.
So I really did. Yeah, I really drank from the fire hose of knowledge for a year.
Well, let's begin at the beginning with the research of George Church. Can you tell us about his work?
George, I'm sure many of your listeners know, was one of the people who kicked off the Human Genome Project. But now I went to see him, talk to him about two things. The first thing was something called the Personal Genome Project. So Craig Venter's famously said recently that the Human Genome Project has taught us nothing. It hasn't really helped us with the healthcare options that we thought would flood out of that project. And that's because we haven't really understood the relationship between our genetic code and our environment. So we don't really know why Uncle George had a heart attack. Was it always in his genes, or was it some as yet undiscovered link between his genetic makeup and working in a laundry and eating mustard sandwiches? So what the Personal Genome Project is doing is trying to tease out the relationship between your genetic code and the environment you live in. And it's doing that by sequencing 100,000 genomes of volunteers, asking those volunteers a bunch of incredibly invasive personal questions, getting access to their medical records, and keeping tabs on them over a period of time. And the idea is that by examining that data set, we will start to be able to see that, yes, okay, people with this genome really shouldn't have bananas and tequila together because it's bad for them. But while I was there, I also discussed the revolution that's coming in synthetic biology. So we're quite good at reading genomes, but our ability to write them and alter genomes of bacteria is less advanced. And that leads to all sorts of incredible possibilities. He advises so many companies, and often some of them are competing companies, because he really wants to get things moving quickly. And one company he advises, for instance, is a company called Jewel Biotech. And what they have done is they've created a bacteria that can eat CO2 and excrete gasoline, which leads us to the possibility that we could take CO2 out of the atmosphere, turn it into gasoline, and you have basically a carbon-neutral petrol station you can put anywhere on the planet. So this synthetic biology revolution, the ability to alter the genomes of life forms and get them to do things that we want them to do, is incredibly, incredibly powerful, but of course raises a whole bunch of ethical issues, and I discuss those in the book as well.
For example?
If you could engineer a particularly virulent virus. There's an example of a mouse pox virus. Despite its pox label, the mouse pox virus is actually quite benign. And some Australian researchers were trying to engineer a new contraceptive out of this mouse pox virus. So what happened there was they altered, I think, just one or two genes into this mouse pox virus, and it became a laboratory-wide rodent genocide. The lethality of the virus, like, rocketed. And the implication there, of course, is, okay, well, what's to say we can't take something else that's benign, fill it with it a bit, and all of a sudden you've got this pathogen. What was very worrying about this particular mutation was it seemed to be very resistant to vaccines or anything else. So this ability to alter the genome and the genetic code of things has bad implications as well as good implications. And we have to work out how we get more of the good and less of the bad.
Well, this is really one of the themes of your books, because you do call it an optimist's guide, but I think you do balance the idea between this is what we could possibly expect. These are the potential benefits, but here are all the other things that we should be horribly afraid of.
I think it would be a completely naive and easily shot down book if I hadn't, you know, referenced all the bad things. And as I said, I didn't start off wanting to write an optimistic book. The reason I wanted to cover that bad stuff was because I wanted the reader to realize I hadn't forgotten it. But one of the things that it tends to happen is that as soon as we hear about the bad things, we tend to say, well, we've got to stop everything. And there's a precautionary principle, which is very sensible in some cases. But I believe there's a kind of fatalism about the future that's prevalent. And what that means is we're tending to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And there was a great quote by a man I met called Marc Badeau. He's a philosopher and an ethicist. He is a synthetic biology pioneer as well. He's the editor of Artificial Life at MIT. And he said this brilliant, brilliant thing, which I think is probably at the core of the book, which is change will come. And you can try to ignore it, you can try to stop it from happening, or you can try to influence it in a positive direction. Trying to stop it from happening is futile. Ignoring it seems irresponsible. So that only really leaves you one option, which is how do you influence it in a positive direction? So what I'm saying is let's put some of those good options back on the table, and then let's use our critical thinking skills and our human ingenuity to make sure we get more of the good and less the bad. And I'm very clear in the book, there are going to be accidents, there are going to be outrages. There will be a nanotech 9/11, there will be a biotech 3 Mile Island. Every new technology has its atrocities and outrages. On balance, though, new technologies have far more benefits than atrocities. And that's always been the case in history. That's why we're not still in caves grunting at each other. But you have to be aware of those things. You have to engage them. Otherwise, you look incredibly naive.
Well, you actually made the comparison to blood transfusions as well.
Yeah, well, that was my own personal experience. I mean, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for blood transfusions. I had a very serious car accident when I was 10 years old, and it took them 3 hours to cut me out of the car, and I lost a lot of blood. And that whole rescue effort would have been a complete waste of time if a man called James Blundell back in the 19th century hadn't pioneered blood transfusions. And, you know, you try to imagine somebody saying, well, we're not going to do blood transfusions today. We're going to roll back technology or roll back the march of medicine, and it would be an outrage. So, you know, if we accept that we want the benefits and advances of new technologies, then we have to look at what they've done for us in the past, which is good. And we also have to try, as I say, to use our best faculties to limit the bad. And the big problem I found with that was nothing to do with science and technology. I came to this conclusion, there's actually a really big problem with innovation. And the problem is institutional, in that when you talk about innovation, we very happily reference science, technology, we might even reference music or dance or what's happening in fashion. But we very rarely talk about institutional innovation, how institutions are moving to change the way they work, to embrace new ways of working, or these new technologies. And the classic example of that is government. Our legislature moves at a much slower pace than the pace of innovation. The time constants are very different. And I find that particularly worrying. They talk a lot about innovation, but they don't innovate in the way they work. And I think there's a very big clash coming down the line. This is one of the things I'm perhaps most worried about, is where you'll start to see government really failing. And I think that's my biggest worry, which is, again, why we need all people of good conscience to be in the games, finding new ways to work together.
Seconded, sir.
Well, good.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm talking today with the author of An Optimist's Tour of the Future, Mark Stevenson.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also subscribe to the show in iTunes or listen to past episodes, and while you're there, why not add your review? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
So, after all of the political conversation, let's talk robots. I'd like to talk about Leo.
Leo is a robot that's sitting in the personal robotics lab at MIT, and he is the world's most sociable robot. And that doesn't mean he's always out clubbing and chatting to girls. But what he is able to do is interact with you in a way that seems very human-like. He'll shrug his shoulders if he doesn't understand a question. He cocks his head to one side when he's listening. And very quickly, you start to interact with him in the normal way that you would interact with another human. This area of sociable robotics, I think, is fascinating because it leads us to this idea that our relationship with technology might become a lot more like friendship. That your computer will understand you when you're shouting at it, going, no, no, save, no, oh, God, and your documents disappeared. Now, you won't get there because it will realize from the tone of your voice that things are going horribly wrong. It'll begin to understand what you really want. So I think that's a brilliant idea. One of the things that I found fascinating about my investigations into robotics and artificial intelligence was summed up by Steven Pinker. He said, we've discovered when it comes to robotics that the hard things are easy and the easy things are hard. And by that, he means, and I agree with him, that it's relatively easy to get a robot or computer to beat Garry Kasparov at chess, as Deep Blue famously did in the late 80s. But it's almost impossible to get them to recognize a face or learn to speak in a natural conversational style like you and I are doing right now. And what a lot of roboticists are trying to do now is basically build a robot child and then take it through a process of learning in the same way it would teach a normal child. And that makes a lot of sense. I mean, if you look at children when they walk, they spend months falling over thousands and thousands of times. These skills are hard won, and the ability to abstract, the ability to understand that somebody else has a different opinion on something than you do, are not things that we learn very easily. It takes us years and years to do it. And so what you're seeing now is an interesting link between roboticists and people who have an interest in child development. At the moment, the roboticists are taking a lot from the child development people. But now slowly you'll begin to see that in trying to build a mind that grows and learns like a child, the child development people are beginning to learn stuff as well because it's helping us frame questions about what it means to be human, what it means to be conscious. Technology is increasingly forcing our hand to tackle those big philosophical questions. What is compassion? What is a set of morals? What does it mean to be human? What is consciousness? Now, we still haven't answered those questions, but I think we're beginning to frame them much more eloquently.
Well, I didn't realize that there was sort of, I guess, competing schools of thought around teaching robots. There's the idea that maybe you should program reasoning, but other people think that reasoning, I guess, is kind of a red herring altogether, and that sense and react approach is more effective.
Rodney Brooks, who I quote a lot in the book, and he very generously allowed me to quote from his fantastic book, Flesh and Machines, he kind of broke the rules because the idea was that you would try and build in intelligence by creating mental models of the world that the robot would refer to. And he said, this is rubbish. We get the robot to react through its senses into the world that it's in, rather than trying to be these abstract models. And he was able to create a robot called Alan that, just by sensing and interacting with its environment, was able to navigate much more easily than these other robots that have been programmed to have these mental images of the world. There's this great story of Hans Moravec, who is one of the great robotics pioneers, programming something which is unflatteringly called the CART at MIT. It was a robot called the CART. He had given the robot a mental model of the world and sent it out there to try and navigate around it. But then when the sun changed, the shadows changed. And so it was much easier for Hans to run out and change the world, as he moved things around so the shadows are right again, than for the robot to recode its mental model. And this is clearly wrong. You can't change the world every time it doesn't agree with you. So Brooks came along and said, no, I want a sense and react robot. He created Alan, which just, you know, worked out where everything was by feeding sensors all the time. And it was able to navigate and do all sorts of things that started to look much more intelligent than the so-called intelligently programmed robots. And Brooks, you know, said, what's really interesting about robotics is you see that things that are regarded as worth pursuing are generally the things that white old male scientists regard as intelligent, you know, like playing chess and solving word problems and stuff. You know, walking across a room and recognizing a face is not something they regard as, you know, really worthy of their vast intellect. And he realized, of course, that any kind of intellect is actually built on top of a substrate of being able to sense and react in the world. And what Cynthia is doing, the lady at MIT who's created Leo, is she's sort of building on that model, but now that what the robot is doing is sensing your mood or it's sensing the environment around it, and it's reacting in a social way.
Would you say Hod Lipson's work is anti-old white guy? Because we're talking about self-awareness here.
Hod Lipson, he's a great guy. He did this amazing thing where he created a robot that is arguably self-aware in that he didn't tell it how it looked. So he put this robot brain in, but he gave it a sort of a set of heuristics and reasoning skills so that it would test various of its motors and servers and whatever and find out what position it was in when it moved one or the other. And slowly over a period of time, it was able to create these models and say, well, am I this shape or am I that shape? And it would do experiments to test. And it would always do an experiment where the models it had built up had the most disagreement. And eventually, over a period, it didn't take very long, it was able to work out, I'm a starfish. Okay, it's not really a starfish, I've got four legs, but I'm this four-legged thing. And then Hod gave it the task of getting across a line. And it basically taught itself to walk from first principles. Now, I have to say, if you see that robot walk, in inverted commas, it's not particularly elegant. It's more gin and tonic than Ginger Rogers. But it is still an impressive achievement from a standing start. This brain worked out the shape of the body it was in and then was able to move that body across the line. But then there's what he did next, I think, which was even more outstanding. He, with his colleague Michael Schmidt, began to think, well, if it can start to build a model of itself through oppressive reasoning and then, work with that, can it build models of other things? If we feed it other data about the world around it, can it start to derive equations that explain that world? And they fed it the data of a double pendulum swinging and allowed it to say, okay, feed me the data of the double pendulum starting in from this position or that position. And pretty soon, because it built up all these models, it was putting the pendulum right at the top, straight up, because half its model said it would fall left, half its model would say it would fall right. And from a standing start, it came up with the laws of conservation of energy in 3 hours. And that obviously surprised him a little bit. And as soon as he published, you can now buy this software and load it down to computer. It's called Eureka, and you can get it from Cornell's Artificial Intelligence Lab on the web. And as soon as he published that, he had lots of people sending him data, going, well, we've got loads of data. We can't really understand. Can you make sense of it? So CERN sent him a whole stack of data to do with particle energy levels and so on and so forth. And sure enough, fed it to this robot brain, and it came up with this beautiful equation. And he sent it back to CERN, and they went, oh, we already know that one. Now, for them, it was a disappointment. For them, it was a disappointment, but for Hod and his team, it's like, hang on a minute, our robot has just come up with, this equation that other people are famous for. The big stumbling block they got to was that it still took a human being to realize what it meant.
Right.
Somebody shows you an equation, it's just like, well, it's an equation, but, I don't know what the variables are or what the environment this experiment was done in. It kind of makes no sense. And he set it looking at, I think it was yeast production in a soil bacterium or something similar to that. And sure enough, it came up with this equation, and they had no idea what it meant. And they sat there for months kind of scratching their heads and drinking lots of coffee and going, and I would email Hod occasionally and go, have you found out what it means yet? He went, no. He says, I can't really publish until we know what it is.
Oh.
And then eventually, they got the robot to explain it to them by doing another set of experiments on the result and getting it to draw links between existing knowledge and the equation it had. So again, perturbing a set of data, asking itself questions and kind of going, where are these two things similar? Because what it does is it looks for invariance. It looks for things that always stay the same, even though the data is changing. So the square of something might stay the same, or the square root of two things added together might stay the same, even though everything looks crazy. And so now you've got this point where a robot can begin to find new knowledge and begin to explain what that new knowledge is to its creators, which means that the pace of science, particularly data-driven science, can start to speed up quite radically. And that means that human beings can spend a lot more of their time doing the things that they're actually very good at, which is deriving meaning or thinking about the implications of a new piece of knowledge, rather than spending a whole career doing experiments just to come up with an equation.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm talking with Mark Stevenson, author of An Optimist's Tour of the Future. So let's talk about the internet. Who did you talk to about my favorite thing?
That is your favorite thing?
That is my favorite thing.
Wow, really? Mm-hmm. Of all things?
Of all things.
Even more favorite than a really good kiss?
Oh, you ask hard questions. Can I withhold judgment on that too? I'd like to receive more evidence on that.
Okay, so listeners out there, Desiree wants more evidence on this. If you could form an orderly queue and see if anybody can kiss her in a way that makes her think the internet isn't quite as cool as it used to be.
Wow. Yeah. That's something.
We're all scientists here, or we all believe in the scientific method. And if you have to go through an observational process to collect data on great kissing to see if you prefer kissing to the internet, then I think this is something we need to do. Not you and me, obviously. My girlfriend.
Obviously, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yes. Anyway, the internet. So we move on. I was very lucky to go and see a man called Vint Cerf, who is often called the father of the internet, which upsets him greatly. But he's certainly one of the fathers of the internet. He was one of the guys who came up with the packet switching protocol that the internet is based on. And I went to see Vint at his house. His house is very nice. I mean, the man who invented the internet, he's not short of a penny or two. We sat in the library. We had a very, very nice glass of Merlot. And we talked about the virtues of interconnectedness and how that is changing the way we interact with each other and with knowledge. And I mean, I'm not sure entirely what to say that probably your listeners won't know already or have intrinsically got, that we are becoming more collegiate, that we are able to share data more easily, that this is driving all sorts of abilities for us to congregate around ideas or causes much more easily. Now, there are some bad things to that. So it's very easy now for you to find a particular echo chamber of hate if you want to get into it, if you're a racist or a sexist or a religious extremist. You know, you can find people. Before, you might have been the only guy in a radius of, you know, 100 miles who was like that. Now you can find 10 people like that across the world and start to do, you know, have a conversation where you're reinforcing your prejudices. I mean, I also found, you know, toenail collectors who had found other toenail collectors on a slightly more humorous note, but wackos can find each other more easily. But in general, what we tend to do is we tend to find each other to do much more useful, interesting and collaborative things. Wikipedia is, of course, a classic example, but there are hundreds of examples of that happening. It is, you know, one of the most extraordinary things on the planet. One of the things that it certainly contributes to is the decline of violence, which is one of the most underreported trends ever, that violence is declining and plummeting at an incredible rate, even as we think the world is more violent. And the internet has a role to play there, I suppose, because why do we feel the world is more violent when actually it's a lot less violent? And if you don't believe me, you can go and check the figures. I did, because I didn't believe it either. Violence is declining. We think it's more violent, and that's for two reasons. One is that violence is now the exception, rather than the kind of social norm it was just a few hundred years ago. But also, because of our increasing interconnectedness, it's very easy for us to become aware of violence wherever it happens in the world. So I think our interconnectedness, whilst it makes us more collegiate, it exposes more violence to us, and therefore we fear that the world's getting more violent. And Robert Wright, the philosopher, worries about this. He calls it a negative reinforcement, I think, and we have to be careful. It's the idea that, you know, you're less likely to get burgled, but if a burglar comes into your house, you're thinking, I don't really want to kill him, but he probably wants to kill me, so I better kill him first. And the burglar's probably thinking, I don't really want to kill him, but he probably wants to kill me, so I better kill him first.
Right.
So you get this negative reinforcement. So thinking the world is more violent is a dangerous trend.
Okay, so there's many, many wonderful things about the internet, I believe. I know. So I guess what my real concern is, so what if something happened to just make the internet just stop? I just gave myself chills even saying that out loud.
It is certainly true that we are completely entangled with our technology. And that's always been the case ever since we invented fire. If you tried to take fire away from the people who invented it, you know, 6 months later, they probably wouldn't be able to handle it. It is almost impossible to stop the internet. Me and Vint discussed this. To stop the internet would require every single ISP in the world simultaneously shut down all the routers. So whilst it's not technically impossible, it is staggeringly unlikely. But you can do it in certain places. I mean, we saw this in Egypt recently.
Exactly.
Where they almost took the country offline. But the fact is they didn't. They couldn't take the country completely offline. People were still using proxies and dial-ups to get through. I mean, of course, it was designed to be a network that wouldn't go down in the event of a nuclear war. That was the whole point behind its very first instantiation, when it was the ARPANET. So I don't think we need to worry about the internet stopping.
Thank you.
I mean, some people worry about other things, that it just carries on, it becomes conscious, takes us all over, and here we are in the Matrix. I mean, those people are wrong.
I'm glad you clarified.
In my humble opinion.
Now, you know, we don't have enough time to cover all of the topics that you discussed in the book and all of the experts that you spoke to. What I do want to mention is you did point out 5 different kinds of nanotech apocalypse.
Yeah, I mean, there are various nanotech apocalypses. One is the kind of economic apocalypse, where one nation gets hold of nanotechnology to such a level that all of a sudden it can start to manipulate matter in a way that means you can pretty much create anything. It has localized abundance. And that means it doesn't need to trade anymore with anybody else, because it can manufacture whatever it wants from the bottom up. And you have this kind of economic crisis. If you extend that worldwide, then you might have a place where there's going to be a power vacuum, because obviously a lot of power is based on the ideas of who controls what. If you suddenly have a power vacuum, then another theory of the nanapocalypse is somebody like a dictator can come in and take over, and they might use nanoweapons in order to suppress us. The thing that most people, I think, are genuinely worried about is ubiquitous surveillance. If you can have nano-sized surveillance devices, then it's not terrorism using nanoweapons you should worry about, but the ability to suppress anything like terrorism. That would be the scariest thing. However, you tend to find that as surveillance technologies increase in their ubiquitousness and their ability to penetrate our lives, the ability to spot them and have warning signs against them also comes up. So, for instance, you can buy firewalls which tell you about viruses trying to get on your computer. There are devices now you can buy to see if there's any unknown or unauthorized wireless activity in your area. So I think we'll probably have a nano-immune system that will build up at the same time we have nano-surveillance build up. I mean, it's not a given, but if you go back, you hear these worries constantly. You know, you'll hear them 10 years ago about what was happening with the internet. You heard them when cameras were invented. Absolutely. What people tend to do is they tend to focus on the negative side of things. Part of my idea with the book was to say, yes, well done, we need that point of view. But if you only talk about that, then we are in danger of having a fait accompli damage limitation exercise of a world rather than the renaissance that it could be. So can we try and use some of those great critical thinking skills you've got to steer us in the right direction?
Well, and that's actually one of the techniques I use to just ensure that I am being appropriately skeptical of things. I try to figure out sort of where we are now with these technologies, what's being done right at this very second, because then I sort of know how far we might have to go to get to that worst case or even best case scenario. Now, you use the phrase in the book that you're seduced by transhumanism in a way.
Transhumanism is the idea that we can transcend our biological roots through our merging with technologies and increasing medicines, effectively live long, healthy, perhaps, you know, almost infinitely long lifespans. And I know I'm 40 next birthday. And so the idea of being sort of in a rejuvenated body at the age of 25 and having, you know, another 150 years or 200 years to explore this wonderful world and to, you know, what's very good for me personally. I mean, I'm certainly seduced by that idea. But of course, that brings a whole load of ethical issues that if that sort of stuff does start happening, and life expectancies are going up by a quarter of a year for every year that's passed already, and some people think that's accelerating, what happens if we all start living, you know, to 1,000? I was speaking to a friend of mine the other day. He says, I'm married. Living to 1,000 terrifies me. I said, I've got to clarify here. Is it you living to 1,000 or your wife? And he went, ah, yes, good point.
And that's the rub right there. The fact is when you are asked if you would want to live forever, you say no. Most of us say that. But when you talk about all of the things that transhumanism is doing to try to eradicate disease and those kinds of things, you can't say that you don't want that.
Yeah, I often ask this question when I'm doing talks. I ask the audience, you know, who here believes we should continue to battle cancer and fight disease? And pretty much everybody puts their hand up. And then you say, who here believes we should have the technologies to radically extend our lifespans? And they're kind of the same question. I mean, there's obviously a nuance there. I'm playing a little bit of a trick. But I'm alive because of advances in medicine. I wear contact lenses. I have very bad eyesight. I would have been essentially a useless member of society only, you know, 300 years ago because I wouldn't have been able to see. So we are enhanced already. If you have the internet, you're enhanced already. So our technology is now forcing us to really address the big philosophical questions. A genuine, hang on a minute, what does this mean for my kids? There's people wandering around now with stem cell-grown replacement body parts. In North Carolina, the Wake Forest Institute of Regenerative Medicine currently has 22 types of human tissue growing in its laboratories. What does it mean if you can continually replace your body parts?
So really, this book is more of a discussion of the practical applications and the ethics around these issues before we even do have the technology.
Before we have technology, it's too late. I think we're going to get it before we've discussed it. And that's kind of one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, because I think if you're not informed, you make bad decisions. It's called the information age for a reason. So I do firmly believe that you need to be informed, you need to grow your critical thinking skills, you need to be able to tell the difference between what is a piece of opinion and what is a piece of peer-reviewed research, for instance, in a way that you can start to have very sensible conversations about this. But I think everybody should be in that conversation, because the more people that do, I believe the better decisions we'll make. Now, some people disagree with me on that point. Some people say, no, we need to leave it to the experts and the specialists and whatever. I don't hold to that view. I do not make really many predictions about the future. I come to my own conclusions about how I'll live my life based on what I found out, but it's not a prescription for the reader. And I hope that after reading it, other people will kind of go, okay, I've got some questions to answer for myself now.
Mark, thanks very much for being here.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure, especially the bit about kissing. I really enjoyed that.
You can visit Mark Stevenson, author of An Optimist's Tour of the Future, at anoptimiststourofthefuture.com. That link will also be on this episode's show notes on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with Jessica Wapner on drug development after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, it's an hour on scams and charlatans with Dr. Stephen Barrett. He's the creator of Quackwatch, a family of websites that tracks dubious healthcare claims and the people and practitioners who make them. James the Amazing Randy joins us for a history of scams, and Jamie Williams of the Center for Inquiry Vancouver discusses the fact and fiction of ear candling. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 Mountain Time at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm here with Jessica Wapner. Previously, Jessica was managing editor of a monthly oncology review journal, and she now writes about biomedical issues for Scientific American, The New York Times, Slate, Science, etc. She's also the author of the Public Library of Science blog, Work in Progress, exploring the ethics and economics of drug development. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Jessica.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So to start off, can you explain the process by which a new drug is approved for use?
It depends a little bit on whether the drug is a traditional chemical drug or whether it's a biologic, meaning a compound that is sourced in, say, monoclonal antibodies, something that comes from a natural source. But generally speaking, a new compound is created. That compound gets a patent. At some point, the drug company says, okay, this is doing something. They did their tests in petri dishes. They did their tests in animals. And then they're doing their tests in people. And they see that the drug is useful for some application, say, treating a certain kind of leukemia. So at that point, the company files a new drug application with the FDA. The FDA reviews the data and, if all goes well, approves the drug. The drug becomes available, widely available, outside of a clinical trial setting. Now, that new drug gets a certain amount of time to be the only one of its kind on the market. So that means that if a generic manufacturer comes along and says, okay, we want to make that drug too, there's a certain period of time during which the FDA will not even accept the application from the new company.
Just to be clear then, the patentability of a drug isn't determined by the FDA, though.
No. The patentability is determined by whether the compound itself is unique, not whether the drug does anything.
So does having a patent or not have any effect at all on the FDA approval process?
No. The FDA approval process is strictly based on whether the drug is safe and effective. Patenting, or rather in this case, market exclusivity, will determine when the FDA might review the drug, but it doesn't determine whether or not the FDA will review it at all.
So what exactly does the FDA base its approval on then?
Well, safety and efficacy are the two aspects that it looks for. So is the drug safe for human use? So they're going to look at what are the side effects of a drug, ranging from death, obviously, at the worst case, to hair falling out, which is a common side effect of chemotherapy drugs. And efficacy, meaning ideally, does it cure the disease? And whether or not it does that, does it extend life? Does it benefit the person? Other marks of benefit would include whether it improves a person's quality of life, or if a drug is specifically for treating a side effect, like, say, the nausea and vomiting that accompany chemotherapy drugs, does it do that job effectively?
So now the FDA approval process is basically protection for the consumer then, correct?
Yeah, I mean, the FDA was created for the purpose of protecting people. If you go back and think about the snake oils of yesteryear, at some point there needed to be some kind of oversight. So the FDA really evolved out of a need for some kind of regulatory body of experts who could look at a new drug and say whether it worked or not.
So then if they're all nice and protected, how about the drug development companies or the research companies themselves? Their protection is patents then, I assume.
Right. So there are many, many different measures put in place, and all of the measures have evolved over the years as different needs have arisen and as the consequences to the previous measures have played out, new measures have been put in place. So a drug company can patent a new compound, and a drug company can patent a successful drug. It's not exactly patent. In that case, it gets called market exclusivity, meaning that that drug gets to be the only drug on the market for that specific class and indication, meaning it's basically, it ends up being the only drug of its kind on the market for some period of time.
Right.
So they are two layers of protection for the company. And market exclusivity is actually better than patent protection. Legally, those are two different things. And it's confusing exactly how they're different, but it's better to have market exclusivity than it is to have a patent in terms of profit. And then a drug can also have its data protected, meaning that if a company develops a new compound and it's successful, a manufacturer of a generic drug can't use the data that was generated by that first company. Okay, so you have a brand name, new drug on the market. It works for a disease. A generic manufacturer says, okay, we want to create the generic version of that. The data from the original clinical trial for the original drug is protected for some period of time. The generic manufacturer can't use the data to apply for their own drug approval with the FDA. They would either have to do an entirely new clinical trial on their own, or they have to wait for some period of time before they can use the data.
So how long does that protection last then?
Well, it depends on what type of drug it is. One of the recent developments under the healthcare reform bill that was recently passed here in the States extends data exclusivity for biologic drugs. And not all new drugs are biologic drugs, but you can think of them as being one of the hot areas of drug development. So right now, data exclusivity has been extended to 12 years.
So under the current law, what can data exclusivity be extended for? What kind of reasons?
As I understand it, under the current law, meaning the new one that's being enacted now, data exclusivity can be extended for pediatric application. That means that if a drug is originally tested in adults and is then found to also work in children, it gets an additional 6 months. The new law actually is intended in part to prevent the practice of evergreening, as it's called, meaning that a drug company creates a drug, gets its however many years of data exclusivity, and then finds a new indication for that drug. So in theory, letting a drug company keep its handle on the marketplace for a long time, preventing a generic manufacturer from getting their cheaper generic version in there.
So let's say a company creates a drug that treats depression, and they get FDA approval and they're selling it as an antidepressant. And then they figure out that it's also good at helping people quit smoking. So once the drug gets approved for use as a smoking cessation aid and the data exclusivity is extended, does that just mean that a generic manufacturer can't have access to the research on using the drug to help people quit smoking? Or does that mean the research on depression stays off limits for longer as well?
The short answer would be, I actually don't know.
Okay.
The longer answer would be that the new law is actually written in a way that isn't entirely clear. And it looks like it's going to be a matter of the FDA figuring out how it's going to interpret the law. So it might be that after the first, say a new drug comes on the market, after 4 years, the generic manufacturer might be able to have access to the data, but the FDA can't actually approve the generic until after 12 years. So there's this vagueness in the law, and it's going to just simply be a matter of time to see whether the FDA says, no, generic manufacturer, you cannot use this data at all for 12 years, or no, you can have access to the data after 4 years, but we're not going to approve the drug until it's been 12 years.
Okay, so we're only speaking about how the data can be used by generic manufacturers at this point.
Yes, it might be after 12 years and it might be after 4 years. And that's not entirely clear. Right now, when you start looking into it, it's called 12 years of data exclusivity. But there's always loopholes and there's always vagueness. And that's the thing about laws.
And this is why we also do segments on this to try and sort this out.
Yeah, so. And I wish it were easier to sort out.
No.
Complicated. And because it's new, there's no track record. A lot of it is a matter of loopholes and pharmaceutical companies finding ways to extend the life of their drug at its high price.
Right.
Right. Because we know, obviously, this whole issue is because as soon as the generic drug comes on the market, the price goes down. So what are the different ways that are delaying access to the generic version of a drug? And when is that reasonable and when is that not reasonable?
I'm trying to really wrap my head around, until I read your blog post, I didn't realize that there were all these different sort of segments within a patent, which are not exactly a patent. But like data exclusivity and market exclusivity, I didn't realize they were two separate things at all.
Yes, the idea that you can patent data is very interesting, especially considering the fact that most clinical trials are funded by federal grants, which means taxpayers, right? So then the idea that a drug company owns the data, there is a law in place that transfers ownership of a compound that was created using federal grant money. But the idea that you can also transfer ownership of data is intriguing, I think.
Well, actually, that was a question from Alan. He did ask specifically about data exclusivity, and if it is from government-funded research, shouldn't that data that's generated by taxpayer money be available to the public?
That's a great question. And so it was the Bayh-Dole Act from 1980, which originally transferred control of a physical item developed at a college. So, you know, a university researcher's stumble on a compound using grant money from the government. And the Bayh-Dole Act created a law by which ownership of that item could be transferred to a private drug company, which is important because if it stays at the university, nothing's going to happen. And you could say the same for the data. If you can have a clinical trial either largely funded by federal grants or entirely funded by federal grants, but nothing is going to happen with the data without a drug company. So there's a reason why you would want the drug company to have so-called ownership of the data for a certain period of time.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm talking about drug development and data exclusivity with biomedical writer Jessica Wapner. Now, maybe you can explain the arguments for extending these protections from the perspective of the drug company, let's say.
Well, the basic argument is pretty simple. Drugs, and in this case, biologics, cost a lot of money to develop. Data exclusivity is intended to protect the drug company's invention so that they recoup all of their investment and make a profit. The overarching theme here is spurring innovation. So the argument here is that prolonging data exclusivity would protect the drug company's investment, make sure they get a profit, and thereby encourage them to keep developing new drugs, which should theoretically help us all stay healthier and live longer lives.
And part of this is because research and development is so expensive, correct?
Yeah, so they say. It's impossible to get hard numbers, but it is expensive.
Oh, interesting. It's hard to get hard numbers? Why?
There's so many different factors that go into running a clinical trial. And the cynical view on why it's hard to get the hard numbers is because drug companies use the cost of research and development as their justification for the high price of drugs. Drugs are very expensive to develop, so that's why the price needs to be set so high. So if you could go and find all the numbers, then that argument might not hold quite as much water as it does now.
Right.
That's the cynical view. That's not necessarily the truth, because these drugs, especially biologics, are expensive to develop. You can't mass produce them. The process to create them is painstaking and takes a long time, and you have to have special facilities devoted to it. And the clinical trials, of course, take a long time.
Well, we have a question from Barbara Drescher. How can the public trust that clinical trials are conducted in an unbiased manner? Even if independent researchers are hired for these, isn't there a conflict of interest?
Well, I think that's a great question. And again, it's an issue that I think is very difficult to look at in a black and white way. I can tell you my point of view on it is that I choose to believe that there are people working in my best interest and your best interest and in the best interest of many, many people suffering from terrible diseases. So I'm glad that there are people out there developing new drugs that will hopefully help cure diseases or prolong the life and minimize the suffering of people who are afflicted. But that being said, it is very, very difficult to find any doctor involved in running a clinical trial that doesn't have some tie to a drug company. That doesn't necessarily mean they're biased. And I think it's important to not assume that because somebody, say, is a paid speaker for a pharmaceutical company, that that makes them horribly biased in conducting a clinical trial. I don't think that that's a totally fair assessment. But that being said, there are conflicts, and there's a lot of studies out there that would say when you have a tie to a drug company, you will be biased. But that being said, a clinical trial for a new drug is done in a way that is randomized, meaning that patients enrolled in the study are randomly assigned to receive the experimental drug or not. And they're blinded, meaning that the doctor treating the patient in the clinical trial doesn't know whether the patient is getting the experimental drug or not. And of course, neither does the patient.
So I'm assuming, and if I can put words in Barbara's mouth, but the idea that we would be getting valid results, and not just valid results, the true results, you know, not fraudulent results from the companies. For example, if it's so hard to get the numbers just around how much money is spent around clinical trials, is it equally as hard to get the data?
On the one hand, yes, and on the other hand, no. There are a lot of people who would say that the results that we see from clinical trials have more holes than we would be led to believe. So, for example, one of the gold standards, let's say, for determining whether a new drug is effective or not is something called the p-value. And the p-value measures what's called statistical significance. So take the experimental drug compared to the standard treatment. Is the survival benefit seen with the experimental drug statistically significantly different to that seen with the standard or what's called the control arm of the trial? So determining statistical significance has a time-tested computation attached to it. But at the same time, when you start to really delve into it, it's questionable. how the statistics work and how the data can be manipulated to show a difference when there isn't a difference, or if the data presented to the FDA, for example, show a statistically significant difference in, say, progression-free survival, which would mean not that a patient is living longer, but that the time until their disease progresses is longer with the experimental drug.
So that being the case then, would extending the data exclusivity sort of extend the amount of time until you could find out the true nature of those clinical trials?
No, the only thing that will show the true nature of a clinical trial is time, showing whether the drug, once it's on the market, is really benefiting the patients that it says it's going to benefit, or if by chance a completely other population of patients is shown to have a benefit, as has happened with some cancer drugs over the years, and whether there are side effects that either were played down during the FDA review process or that just weren't detected.
Well, then, from the perspective of the consumer, are there good reasons for extending the protection then?
From the perspective of the consumer, the argument would be that data exclusivity helps spur drug innovation. And if we want more treatments available to us, then we should give that extension to drug companies because it helps them have the resources to reinvest into new drugs.
Well, now, how about the arguments against extending it then?
Well, that argument is also pretty straightforward. The sooner a generic drug comes on the market, the lower the drug price is. I think there's also an argument to be made in favor of generics because they spur competition too. If a drug company knows that their new drug has only a few years on its own on the market, then shouldn't that spur them to go back and get more drugs onto the market?
Now, conversely, one of the arguments that I've heard about this is that if companies aren't going to make a certain amount of money off of a drug, then those companies would just stop making new drugs. Is that legitimate in any sense?
I don't know if there's a way to prove that or not, because if there's money to be made, then there will be a drug company creating a drug. There are some stories from history that are informative. There's the story of the leukemia drug Gleevec, which was one of the first cancer drugs targeted against a specific genetic abnormality. The makers of Gleevec originally wanted to shelve the drug because the kind of leukemia that it treats occurs in relatively few people, and they thought that there was no way that they would be able to make money off of the drug, even though everybody knew that the drug worked. The company was about to refuse to make the drug because they couldn't make money from it. So eventually Gleevec was created, and it turned out to be a blockbuster because the drug has to be taken every day. So people with this kind of leukemia take Gleevec once a day for the rest of their lives, and that's why the drug turns out to make money. The makers of Gleevec didn't know that at the outset, so they didn't have a guarantee that the drug would make as much money as it's made for them. So here's another example of a drug that started out requiring legislation to help it get onto the market, but that then became a huge blockbuster. So Botox was originally created for a disease that occurs in very few people and causes neck spasms and also affects the eyes, or it's two different diseases, but they were so-called orphan diseases, which are diseases that occur in 200,000 people or fewer. And Botox was originally found to treat those diseases. And the only reason it was able to be developed is because of the Orphan Drug Act, which is a set of provisions for drugs that are treating diseases that occur in very few people, meaning that a drug company needs to know that if it creates this drug, it's still going to be able to make a profit, even though the drug is only going to be purchased by relatively a handful of people.
Right.
So that drug was approved. under the Orphan Drug Act, so it had some benefits in terms of market exclusivity, in terms of federal grant money, and other things that just helped the company make money off of this drug. It was later found to have this incredible benefit of smoothing wrinkled skin. And what's interesting about that is it raises a lot of questions. So Botox was originally created under the Orphan Drug Act. So the provisions that were given to it, should the drug maker give some money back to the government because it was found to have this incredible blockbuster use? Should data exclusivity be extended when it was found to work on wrinkled skin? These are some of the issues that get raised that really aren't that easy to answer, because there's the law and there's also what's best for people, and those two don't always coincide. You know, it sounds so sinister to say it, but at the same time, healthcare is market driven. Right. And how can a drug company make a new drug when they're not, it's not a not-for-profit humanitarian organization, it's a drug company. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, it sounds horrible that they had this effective drug that they were about to shelve when people are dying from a disease. And on the other hand, like, okay, well, how are they going to develop a drug that they can't make money from?
Right.
It's the puzzle for me anyway. I think it really gets to the heart of the conundrum of having a market-driven healthcare world.
I have a question from Chris. Do you think under the laws in the U.S. that protecting consumers takes a backseat to trying to create incentives for innovation? Should there be more focus on that aspect of the process?
It's a great question. If we're talking about creating drugs that can be sold for as little as possible, then probably the consumer could be taken into account more. But at the same time, I think it goes back to the argument that pharmaceutical companies need to have a guarantee of a profit in order to make drugs. And without that guarantee, they won't supposedly make the drugs. So finding ways to help drug companies, I guess you could say, would be also helping the consumer. Consumers and pharmaceutical companies aren't mutually exclusive, right? Because if we want there to be treatments, then there have to be incentives for drug companies to create those treatments. So they're not really as separate as that question might imply. That being said, you know, we're talking about the government and lobbyists and the fact that pharmaceutical companies are huge lobbyists when it comes to the government. And there aren't any laws created that pertain to pharmaceutical companies that don't have huge lobbyists behind them. Right. So it's very hard to know what is in any individual senator's head, but it's all influenced by huge amounts of money.
So as we've said, this is very complicated. I see an ongoing series, segments on drug development. I think that's the only way that we're going to be able to wrap our heads around this.
Yeah, it's complex and it's compelling.
Well, thanks very much for being here, Jessica, and trying to help us figure this out.
Well, thank you for allowing me to take you on this little ride.
You can find biomedical writer Jessica Wapner at blogs.plos.org/work-in-progress. There is also a link to her site on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click the links to Twitter, to Facebook, and to iTunes, where you can download past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells, 'cause we're skeptically speaking. Online reading tarot cards and
witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.